B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, December 11th, 2017. We've got a serious case of mass media malpractice. And I am calling for a stand down on corporate media coverage of the Trump-Russia-Russiagate narrative until they can get their shit together. It's just another daydream from PBC. But on Friday, as Glenn Greenwald has very carefully laid out in a powerful takedown of a huge blunder led by CNN, and then the pack followed CNN right over the cliff. It is a stunning display of arrogance and inaccuracy as the corporate media outlets compete with one another. To be the first to be able to prove that Russia hacked the DNC, gave that to WikiLeaks with the intention of tipping the election to Trump. And the breathtaking report was that an email has surfaced. Turned out that CNN hadn't even seen the email, and whoever read it to them over the phone or represented that they knew about the contents made a critical mistake. But before that was discovered, CNN went on the air, announced that this email showed that the Trumps received from WikiLeaks an encryption key that gave them access to all of these emails about Hillary Clinton before they were released to the public. And this is the collusion because everybody knows that WikiLeaks equals the Russian intelligence agencies, and boom, case closed. In fact, this guy, Ben Wittes, who's an ally of James Comey, he posted in social media a picture of a little cannon going boom. And the little detail that they got wrong was the date of this email that came from a guy named Michael Erickson. He's not a public figure. He's not aligned with Trump or WikiLeaks. He just sent an email to Donald Trump and Don Jr. and said, hey, take a look at what WikiLeaks has. And because the amount of information was too great to just attach on an email, he put it into a zip folder or something like that and sent the encryption key. And I covered this, as I had partially learned about it, in my News and Comment podcast and live video feed on Facebook on Friday afternoon. And I was dismissive of it before I even knew that the date was off by 10 days. And in fact, this was just some loyal Trumpista who was trying to help the campaign by linking them to information that WikiLeaks had published. So CNN reported it. And then I used a Guardian article that was based on CNN. Then CBS said they independently confirmed it and they ran with it. Then MSNBC ran with it, got all hysterical. And when it turned out not to be true, I have not seen a single retraction or apology or even an indication of, whoops, we got it wrong. They just keep moving on and keep hammering the same stuff. By Sunday morning, I watched a little bit of Jake Tapper's show on CNN. He had Adam Schiff there, the Democrat ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, who's always up there to sell us on the Trump-Russia narrative. They didn't mention a word about this massive blunder. And this is not the first time. It wasn't even the first time last week. And this is where Greenwald really is on his game. And I suspect, I have no inside information, but Greenwald is under pressure to get on board with everybody else on the Me Too bus, the groupthink bus. We've seen how his outlet, The Intercept, published that smear by James Risen, the former New York Times reporter, highly respected, who smeared Bill Binney, a man who was a source for some of the critical information that Risen revealed about domestic surveillance and the NSA. So this is a massive blunder. And the reaction to it, or the lack of a reaction, by the people who foisted it on us, suggests to me that if this whole Trump-Russia collusion thing unravels, that the media won't admit it. They'll just try to keep moving on, keep you distracted. And, for example, last week, Rachel Maddow breathlessly reported that the German bank, Deutsche Bank, had been served subpoenas to cough up financial records of the Trump family and the Trump organization. Turns out they were subpoenaed for associates of Trump. Now, that's a big difference, but you're not going to hear Rachel Maddow say, hey, by the way, the other night we got it wrong. And that whole 20-minute segment I did about Deutsche Bank and the money laundering of Russians and how that's linked to Trump, well, golly, I can't really establish that that is true. And Greenwald singles out Ken Delanian. And I've mentioned him before. He's one of the people who smeared Bill Binney without even considering the arguments about a leak at the DNC as opposed to a hack. And Ken Delanian came out of the LA Times where he's been exposed for getting prior approval for his articles from friends at the CIA. And so Delaney is clearly one to red flag and to carefully watch. But I've linked to Greenwald's piece, and I have to tell you, it was a little weird as I was driving into the secret studio today, listening to Rush Limbaugh, quoting extensively, liberally, shall we say, from Glenn Greenwald's article. Now, I only caught 20 minutes of Limbaugh's show, so before the part I listened to, it's possible that he talked about this media blunder on Friday, but he mainly focused on the somewhat historical references, the past week of errors and the last year of errors that are summarized in Greenwald's piece. You know, like the phony report that Russian hackers had penetrated the electric grid through a utility in Vermont, and many other mistakes that have been made in the rush to get this story. Not to get it right, but to get it first. And our friend and colleague Bob Perry at Consortium News, he builds on Greenwald's critique, talking about a rash of journalistic embarrassments that have both disgraced the profession and energized Trump's backers over new grievances about fake news. He says, we have rarely witnessed such a cascading collapse of journalistic principles as has occurred around the Russiagate scandal. On Friday, the rush to finally prove the Russiagate narrative led CNN, then CBS, and MSNBC to trumpet an email supposedly sent from someone named Michael J. Erickson on September 4th to Donald Trump Jr. that involved WikiLeaks offering the Trump campaign pre-publication access to purloined Democratic National Committee emails. And as I noted, the story was not accurate. And this only feeds Trump's tweets of taunt at the mainstream media and the predilection of his followers to believe all this. And of course, when they actually run fake news, that helps Trump. And you'd think they'd be a little more careful about this, recognizing that he is always ready to shit on them when they make a mistake. Now, it is fair to say that the New York Times and the Washington Post looked at this and, for whatever reasons, they did not jump into the cesspool. But as Perry points out, the Times continues to report the dubious Russiagate claims as fact. And I have two examples for you today. In the Monday New York Times, that's today, December 11th, they have what's called an explainer. The headline reads, confused by all the news about Russia, we are here to help. And with some charts and graphs and hyperlinks that may lead you to the information that says, well, this is an alleged plot. This is asserted by the CIA. But this summary is intended for the low-information reader who doesn't read the 8-page stories that the Times routinely publishes about these matters. And it just reads like this. In late 2016, top U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that the Russian government directed a massive cyber attack aimed at denying Hillary Clinton the presidency and putting Trump in the White House. This broad campaign included hacking and leaking Democratic emails, pushing false information on Russian media outlets, that's a hyperlink, gaining access to state and local electoral boards, that is a really specious claim that's been made, and using social media to disseminate information. Now, I've debunked all of these individually, and I'm not going to impose on you to repeat all that today. But this is really offensive. To see the most recognized and respected media outlet descend to these levels. And that's in the news columns. Over on the opinion page in the weekend review section of the New York Times, they ran an interesting piece by Rebecca Ruiz, who is an expert on sports doping. Her headline reads, "How Russia Cheats in Sports and Elections." Now, I'm not a sports fan, and I have not followed the details of the Russian doping scandal, but I take at face value the decision by the Olympic Committee to sanction Russia and essentially kick them out of the Winter Games coming up in just a couple of months. But Rebecca Ruiz makes a claim that the pattern of behavior related to sports doping is similar and in some ways linked, that Putin was obsessed about how his Sochi games were ruined by claims of doping, and he blamed the U.S. for that, and that's why he launched this whole hacking marathon. Now, I consider that quite dubious. And Rebecca Ruiz is entitled to her opinion, but she's not entitled to present speculation as fact. And that's what the New York Times is doing on a daily basis. And Sunday, there was a feature in the Times. I read the whole thing. It's lengthy, talked about Trump's feeling embattled and how much television he watches. And it is interesting to imagine the President of the United States getting up 6 a.m., watching 2 hours of cable news before he manages to amble into the Oval Office at 9:30 or so. And we know by all the tweets promoting Fox and Friends bullshit that Trump does watch a fair amount of TV. But given that most of the media royally screwed up on Friday, it gives fresh impetus and credibility to Trump's claims. He says, tweeting this morning at 6 a.m., "Another false story, this time in the failing New York Times, that I watch 4 to 8 hours of television a day. Wrong. Also, I seldom, if ever, watch CNN or MSNBC, both of which I consider fake news. I never watch Don Lemon, who I once called the dumbest man on television." I happen to agree with Trump on that. I don't respect Don Lemon at all. But you get my point. That these serious errors in reporting and in journalistic judgment by major outlets who don't even bother to correct their mistakes. I think the media are headed for a huge fall. They're on a huge tree limb, and they are sawing away close to the trunk. And if Trump wins this war on the media, we are going to be adrift. Without any reference point, without any source of factual information, the fake reality he tries to create on a daily basis will exist where honest reporting will just be dismissed. Today, a 27-year-old immigrant from Bangladesh named Akayed Ula reportedly was wearing explosives that were Velcroed to his jacket, and he tried to detonate a pipe bomb in the Port Authority bus terminal, 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, at 7:20 in the morning, height of the Monday morning rush hour. Now, he apparently was burned and injured, And three bystanders also reported some minor injuries, but there were no fatalities. And, of course, the Trump team piles on, build the wall, change immigration laws, blame it on Obama. Because Sarah Huckabee Sanders says this attack underscores the need for Congress to work with the president on immigration reforms that enhance our national security and public safety. We must protect our borders. We must ensure that individuals entering our country are not coming to do harm to our people, and we must move to a merit-based system of immigration. They have absolutely no sensibility or sensitivity. They just rush in to exploit an event like this and to spin it in a direction that fits the Trump frame. Now, I just saw a headline on the New York Times website that the suspect has told authorities that he was inspired by the Islamic State. There was some speculation he may have been reacting to Trump's designation of Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel last week, but that's not proven. And there is also an unproven claim from a pro-Islamic State media group who said that this was in response to the Jerusalem declaration. And so we move on, and New Yorkers are tough. But the exploitation of this event will not stop here. And who knows what we'll find out about this 27-year-old man. The Prime Minister of Iraq, in a moment that reminds me of George Bush's premature ejaculation about how the major combat operations in Iraq had ended, and then they continued for years and years after that. Well, Haider al-Abadi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, declared victory over the Islamic State Saturday, saying that after 3 years of battles, Daesh has been vanquished. I think it's a little premature. There's still some of those guys on the loose, and I have no idea how they might regroup and mount some sort of new violent challenges. And in reaction to Trump's designation of Jerusalem, the violence has continued with many massive protests across the Middle East. But over the weekend, Israeli airstrikes killed two Hamas members in Gaza. Israel was overreacting to the launch, I believe, of four of these little rockets from Gaza into Israeli territory. No damage, no injuries, but Israel, of course, always uses maximum retaliation. And in Bethlehem, Palestinians hurled stones at Israeli troops who responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, stun grenades. The Israeli military said 600 Palestinians were there throwing firebombs and rolling burning tires toward Israeli forces. Dennis Rodman is publicly asking Trump to designate him as a special envoy or ambassador to North Korea. The former NBA player turned up in Beijing, hoping to fly to Pyongyang, but he was denied entry because of Trump's immigration decrees. And Rodman says, "If I can go back over there, you'll see me talking to him, sitting down, having dinner, a glass of wine, laughing, and doing my thing. I guess things will settle down a bit, and everybody can rest at ease." Well, Rodman, you can say a lot of things about, but he doesn't lack confidence in his own capabilities. He said, "I think a lot of people around the world want me to go just to see if I can do something." All right. And we've been following the fate of Mikhail Saakashvili. He's the former president of Georgia. He has been living in Ukraine, where he was made governor of the Republic of Ossetia. And now he's on the outs with his former patron, Petro Poroshenko, who had Saakashvili locked up on Friday after a failed attempt on Wednesday or Thursday, when Saakashvili went to the roof of his apartment building and managed to be freed by the public, who got him out of a policeman. But they nailed him the next day, took him to jail. He's now on a hunger strike. He's accused of trying to topple the Poroshenko government, but he says that's all false. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Brian Massey, DGL, you know who you are, Bill Goodacre, and Jim McHugh. I'm really grateful to you for your financial support, and I invite others to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on that menu button and pull it down, then become a subscriber. That's what it says. And then come on over to the sign-up page and do your thing. You can choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. I open today with my critique of the corporate media and one story that I find interesting in today's Washington Post offers new information about the murky opposition research company Fusion GPS. These are the people who were paid by the Clinton campaign. They in turn hired Christopher Steele, who created the Trump dossier. Steele, a former British intelligence officer. And I have wondered for months why Fusion GPS has not been the focus of more investigation. And Devin Nunes, the embattled chair of the House Intelligence Committee, he has been cleared of his conflict of interest by the Ethics Committee. But he got into some trouble earlier this year after he said he had recused himself from the Trump-Russia investigation and then, out of nowhere, issued some subpoenas for Fusion GPS. I think that was actually a reasonable thing to do. But we learned that it was started by a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and the team is former journalists. It bills itself as a corporate research firm. But its founder, Glenn Simpson, who worked for the Wall Street Journal, left there in 2009, teamed up with a former Wall Street Journal editor named Peter Fritsch and others. And Glenn Simpson told a panel last year, "I call it journalism for rent." Now, while we know about the Christopher Steele angle, at least somewhat, what the Post reports here for the first time is that Fusion GPS was hired by unnamed clients in the San Francisco area to support George Lucas, the Star Wars creator, who was trying to get approval for a proposed Museum of American Art that he's collected on the grounds of the former military base, the Presidio, which is a beautiful spot that abuts the Golden Gate Bridge. And long story short, Lucas never did get approval for his plans. They were ridiculed by the people who reviewed it, and my late friend Richard Rappaport, the journalist, wrote a number of commentaries for the San Francisco Chronicle in opposition to the museum plans. But Ron Conway, who really is the mayor of San Francisco, he's the ventriloquist to a guy named Ed Lee, who purports to be our mayor. Conway is a Silicon Valley investor who's made money on a lot of startups, and he appears to be at least the contact for Fusion GPS in their effort to turn things around for the Lucas Museum. Now, a spokeswoman for Lucas, who may in fact be a good friend of mine, she's not named here, says in a statement that George was unaware of any research undertaken by Fusion GPS. But they did do a lot of digging. They used public records requests, and they hired third parties, mostly former journalists, to do some of the digging for them. Norman Solomon is a good friend and a longtime advocate for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And we reported on Friday that he was almost ejected from the DNC's Unity Reform Commission meeting in Washington, D.C. He was permitted to stay. And I have linked to a piece that he posted today at consortiumnews.com about how the National Democrats continue to resist reforms. He describes how this unity forum was kept secret. People could RSVP online, but those people were never told when and where it was going to be convened. So there was sparse turnout, and the Sanders supporters on the Unity Reform Commission, are already outnumbered by the Clinton supporters. And so it was a very testy exchange. And what we learn from Norman Solomon's piece is that there was some progress made. The commission approved some recommendations that were partial victories for progressives. Among the most notable, it called for reducing the number of notoriously undemocratic superdelegates to the convention from 712 to about 300, when the only democratic number would be zero. Well, you're right about that, Norman. The commission somewhat improved transparency for often dubious DNC contracts with high-paid consultants and vendors, while defeating a sensible amendment by commission member Nomiki Konst. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but I did watch a video clip of Nomiki, and she was very strident and very accurate about the conflicts of interests of many of the party insiders, some of whom serve on the Unity Commission. And, of course, the recommendations that came out of this process must go to the full DNC, including all of those superdelegates who would be voting to... voting to deny themselves the right to be superdelegates at the next convention. Will they do that? Tomorrow is the big day in Alabama. Your humble host is sad to predict that despite the fact that Roy Moore has been accused by two women of serious sexual assault and others of creepy behavior, despite the fact that I got 15 emails today demanding that I kick in $3 for a final push by the candidate on the Democratic side, Doug Jones, to claim victory here, I think that the combination of voter behavior in Alabama, which is to say they elect a lot of crappy people, and the way Republicans are able to fix elections in Alabama, I'm afraid that Roy Moore will be declared the winner by Wednesday morning. I'd love it if I'm wrong, and I'll be happy to eat those words. And while I'm chewing on that, I want to invite you to support Roger and Carol Shuler. Roger, of course, the veteran journalist who's exposed so much of the corruption in Alabama, and he's paid a huge price for it. He can't find work. He's essentially been blackballed. And he lives in a Fleabag motel on a week-to-week basis with Carol. And I know that they are hard up for cash right now. So if you're able to go to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com and chip in the bucks that I'm not sending to Alabama for Doug Jones, I would be much obliged. Now we run down others accused of sexual impropriety or assault, starting with the guy who calls himself president. The women who have accused Trump are getting more aggressive. A group of them have demanded today that Congress open an investigation. And these are women who've leveled pretty serious charges of groping and of sexual assault against the man who sits as president. And if Al Franken took the high road, well, somebody has to force the issue with Trump. An interesting headline from former Mayor Willie Brown in the Sunday San Francisco Chronicle said something to the effect, Democrats, on the way to the high road, run over Al Franken. We also have a case here in San Francisco of Alex Kozinski, the former chief judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I believe he still serves there. Six women have come forward alleging to the Washington Post that Kozinski subjected them to a range of inappropriate sexual conduct or comments, nothing that involved sexual behavior. Also, my friend Stan Glantz, prominent anti-tobacco crusader at the University of California, San Francisco, has been accused by a postdoctoral researcher who worked for him for 2 years that he repeatedly stared at her body and chest, leered at her, forced her to hug him, and made sexually charged remarks. Stan Glantz says that he denies every claim reported to be included in the lawsuit. And Mario Batali, the super chef who runs the Eataly restaurants in Manhattan, there's a new one in Century City in Los Angeles, he is stepping away from his daily operations and his daytime TV show, The Chew, after reports of sexual misconduct that he admits. Again, nothing in the way of rape or sexual assault, just inappropriate behavior. Trump's effort to tweet a ban on transgender persons serving in the U.S. military has been fully rejected by a federal judge in Washington, Colleen Collar Catelli. said in a ruling today the ban likely violates constitutional rights to due process and has ordered the Pentagon to begin enrolling transgender persons starting January 1st. At The Intercept today, a good enterprising report based on video footage from dash cams of Texas highway troopers. And it shows how they pull over Latinos for a taillight or even a fabricated infraction. Then they ask for a driver's license. If they can't produce one, they call immigration. Often, families are separated right there on the highway as mom and a kid loses a dad to deportation. It's really gripping, and the video footage is pretty powerful. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And a new project at Vice News is worthy of mention. They've announced an in-depth report investigation called Shot by Cops and Forgotten. And it builds on work that the Washington Post and The Guardian did a few years ago to expose the number of Americans killed by cops every year. And I haven't had time to fully absorb this. It's a 25-page report. But I think that it actually understates some of the statistics. For example, they say that they went to the 50 largest local departments across the country and gathered data from 2010 to 2016. And during that six-year period, 3,600 people were shot. Not all of them died. 1,378 were killed, but 2,720 were non-fatal. Well, I know that in 2015, there were 1,000 Americans killed by police officers, and the average over this period of time is only 500, so I'm going to have to delve into that a little more deeply. But they note that 20% of the people police shot were unarmed, and of course that African Americans are targeted disproportionately to their populations. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's free. You're free to share it with absolutely everyone. And if the clicks work out, you'll find it on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until